Thanks for joining us for day 9 of the Daily Buzz and the best from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. Coming to you on KCPW and online from Main Street in Park City, Utah. I'm John Wildman of Film Threat. But first, this news.
And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW. I'm Dominic Mill. I am joined by my co-host, James Faust, and our producer, Irene Cho. You doing all right, Irene?
I'm doing great.
You're getting some words in for once. We are also joined by Liz Garbus, the director of What Happened to Miss Simone, which premiered a couple of nights ago. How are you doing, Liz?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
James, Irene, which one of you wants to go from the off? James, fire away.
I'll go. Big fan.
Thank
Love
you.
Love your work.
Thank you.
You're practically super prolific.
Okay, so, I'll take it as a compliment.
Walking into this, I had a chance to see the opening night, and that was one of the most powerful opening nights I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah, baby. Thank you.
That was great. What you've accomplished. When I love documentaries because sometimes you go into something knowing something, and you're like, oh, wow, I want to know more, or you go into something not knowing. I thought I knew Nina Simone.
Yeah.
I thought I knew that person's work.
Yeah.
What I saw in your film was gut-wrenching and a little, it brought some things to light that made sense, especially the when we got into the bipolar thing. So going into this film, what did you know about Nina Simone?
You know, what I knew about Nina Simone was that she was awesome. And, you know, when my husband, my now husband, first came over, you know, to my apartment and I was making him dinner and stuff, you know, what I put on to impress him, it was Nina Simone. And it really worked. It totally worked. But that was what I knew. I knew her music. Yeah. I did not know the woman. So when when I got approached, it came from the estate, you know, that her daughter was finally ready. You know, so many people over the years had approached them. They wanted to do something on Nina, and there were so many people so protective of her legacy. So you could understand, you know, she's a complicated woman. In the wrong hands, you could make her look like a monster. You know, like she had some real dark shit in her life. Am I allowed to curse? No.
Yeah,
okay, sorry. All right, I just did anyway. All right. So she had some dark stuff in her life, and you know, and so they were very protective, you know. And at some point, I think there were a variety of forces out in the world that made them decide they were ready to allow the story to be told and let go. You know, allow the story to be told and not exert control over it. Because I think when that happens, you don't get really, you know, filmmakers don't really want to work when they don't have final cut, you know. So I think they were finally ready to let that happen. And then so I said, somebody called me and they said, are you interested? And I said, look, I love the music. Let me find out more about the life. And I picked up Nina Simone's autobiography and I was like, I read it in like 2 hours. I was like, oh my God, can I get this job? You know, it was just like, you know, so fierce. I mean, I knew she was an activist, but I didn't know she left it all on the mat like that. You know, I knew, you know, one suspects she had troubles in her life and in her family, but I didn't, you know, the dynamic between her and her husband, and of course her own internal demons and living all your life with undiagnosed mental illness and everyone just thinking you're a monster at times and being overcome. And she wouldn't even remember the rages, you know, after they would come over her. And then this mania, you know, she would also have these manic episodes, which would be, you know, sexual or they would be filled with anger. And, you know, to live like that and not have any understanding, you know, that's a lot of suffering.
I wanted to echo James. I was also at opening night, and I really want to applaud you as a female director, as a documentary storyteller. I think you set the tone for the festival, and you raised the bar really high. I, too, was moved by Nina Simone. I didn't realize until I heard the music in the film how much of her music I had really grown up with. It was very... it was so moving. I was weeping throughout the entire film, and I really think that a lot of our listeners can identify with her background, her story, her role as a mother, her role as an activist, and as a songwriter, you know, and you did an amazing job.
Yeah, like who knew, her, you know, her lists as a mom were like I have the same lists, you know, I have kids, like, you know, and that struggle of being a working mother, you know, I relate, you know, it's a very basic feminist struggle, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And she, you know, and so yeah, she's like deeply relatable on different levels than I had expected when I started the film. Yeah.
Well, balance, what was striking to me, one, I didn't know she had a husband. I felt weird, like, oh man, I don't know anything about her. It's one of those things. But and then that relationship was so volatile, and I don't know, indicative of a lot of other sort of music entertainment relationships.
Yeah, like why do you think everyone knows Ike and Tina, but nobody knows Nina and Andy? What do you think? Why?
I don't know.
Because they were more private. Like, did the others? I don't know.
And it's fun. And it's really, I guess. I think her activism was more overshadowing that other relationship.
That's right, yeah.
Because she was out there for other different things, whereas right. Tina and Ike were just making music.
Yeah. I guess so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that I understand that Nina had a story to tell, but she didn't necessarily want to be on a pedestal to tell it.
Right.
So she told... through her lyrics, you know, the fact that she did popular music. I mean, I think that was one of the items of controversy between her husband and her, that she wasn't doing the types of shows that Gladys Knight was doing
or that Aretha Franklin was doing. Yeah, yeah.
But she felt so compelled with that Mississippi Goddamned, with that story when she wrote that song after the... After the incident in Birmingham, Alabama, and that she didn't care about how popular her music was, but she felt it was important for that generation to know the story to know the context. I mean, she's a historical figure in that sense, and how timely, and I'm sure, James, you're going to touch on this, but how timely for that to come out now, and listening to her story through your eyes, how much has not changed.
Well, that's right.
That's what I was most...
Well, so, yeah, there's this interview with Nina in the 1980s where she's being interviewed by another African-American woman and for Essence. And they say to her, how far have we come with civil rights? And Nina looks at her like she's an idiot, you know, and she just gives her that Nina Simone look. And she's like, there are no civil rights. And then she says her songs aren't relevant anymore. And how painful is that statement? And, you know, I think we know they're so relevant today, but how do we make them relevant? You know, how do we bring her voice? You know, I think that's why John Legend came out. You know, I think it's about bringing back that kind of spirit. And of course, there are so many wonderful artists today who are political. I'm not trying to say there are no Nina Simones, but, you know, I don't know. She has a real place today.
What's kind of part what her struggle was as well, like wanting to be on those Ed Sullivan shows or wanting to be on those shows back then because she had something to say. And having a platform, and I'd like to be on those because I bet she wanted to say the things when she was in those concerts and riling up a lot of the choir, if you will, going hey, but tell people that aren't listening.
Yeah,
and I think and that's why John Legend coming out, and I think there is a place. I think there are civil rights. It's just they're just quieter, and it's just not working as hard as it once did.
For our listeners, maybe you guys can reference what John Legend was doing at the opening night, because I think that would give some context.
That John Legend guy.
I missed it. Who is this John Legend?
Oh, you were talking about so after the screening that night, we were treated to a special Academy Award nominee, Grammy winning John Legend came out and sang, I think, three songs from Nina. It was wow. And not only was the songs were great, the lighting was good, the screen went up.
It was poignant.
It was like, we took video. I'll post it on my Facebook later.
Oh, good, because I couldn't see anything.
No.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I'll find it online somewhere because I was backstage, but yeah.
Oh, well, he did. What was the last song he did that she recorded?
Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood.
Yeah, her cover
of somebody else.
Yeah. It was just strong. I mean, there were two people next to me weeping, and I was thinking,
I'd like to jump in and ask you a little bit about how it was like working with her daughter, because you could tell that she was still struggling a lot with her relationship with her mother and the significance of her mother's role in the 60s and in activism and in American history. But I felt that she really made a huge step by telling that story at her own expense so that other people could benefit. I'm curious how that was.
You know, I think Lisa, she's someone, you know, she's in a process, right? Like she grew up with those two parents, right? And, you know, and if you haven't seen the film, you know, you might know that Nina was a temperamental individual, a brilliant temperament, but, you know, also Nina's husband, Lisa's father, was no cakewalk. And he was quite brutal. And, you know, there was... a lot of domestic violence in that household. And so Lisa spent a long time, you know, talking, thinking, recovering, healing. And she's, you know, she's a really spiritual person. And, you know, the emails I get from her now, you know, we did have the opportunity to show her the film before it went public, you know, which was the right thing to do. And, you know, so she said, you know, mommy, I did mommy proud. Like, I'm okay. She gave me no notes. She gave me no criticism. She gave me love. She was just like, namaste. I bless you. We are, you know, I've done my thing. I can move on in my life. I'm going to focus on my career now. I'm moving forward. And who could expect that? Like, I don't think I could look at myself, talk about my family, and not be like, dudes, can you just like, you know, like that level of like peace and zenness and also trust in me as a filmmaker is beautiful. It's so beautiful. And with someone like Nina Simone, and let's not forget, I'm also a white woman, you know, so there it took a leap and like trusting me and like we, you know, talking about that, talking through that. And I don't think you have to be a white woman to make a white, I don't think you have to be a white person to make a film about a white person or a black person to make a film about a black person, but you don't want to like pretend like that's not something that we all need to talk about. And, you know, we had those conversations and I just, her trust in me was just, you know, beautiful. I'm not sure if I were her, I could let go of my family story as easily. And mine is not nearly as exciting and dramatic as hers.
Is there anything, documentary, how much footage did you have of this thing, I mean, end of the day?
Well, we had, as you know, we went all over the earth to find audio tapes of Nina telling her story, and we must have had 70 or 80 hours of Nina talking.
Wow. Her talking.
And that's just Nina talking. And then we had, you know, a lot of tens and dozens and hours of other people talking. And then we had the beautiful, then we had the concert footage, and then we had the Nina interview footage. So there was a lot. And the stills, you know, the amount of stills we had, it was embarrassment of riches. It was wonderful.
So looking back, you finished the film. Is there something when you're watching again or maybe feeling our audience reaction, thinking, you know what, I should have included this part near, because I honestly, it's about 100 minutes, 103.
Yeah,
103. I was thinking, I could actually use about 25 more minutes.
Oh, yeah, me too. Will you call Netflix out?
I will. In that second life when she goes from Liberia to the end
Paris,
of her life,
yeah.
That whole part, I would love to go, I want more of this. These other guys that are coming in that are taking care of her.
Yeah,
and I kept thinking there was more there.
Yeah.
And
going, oh, yeah, there's so much more.
You could do the sequel. This is what happened, Miss Simone.
Yeah.
Netflix,
no, I mean, I'll
Netflix.
Tell you one thing that I regret. One thing that's not in there. And it's like, you just have to make these choices. But I know you all know her song, Four Women.
Yes.
And, you know, that is one song that is just so brilliant. And, you know, but I hope people who don't know Nina Simone, they'll watch this film and then they'll find that song. Yeah. You know, they'll find that song. So
Liz Garbus is the director of What Happened, Miss Simone. It went down a treat as the opening night documentary at the festival this year. Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, and if you haven't checked it out yet, we do have 3 more screenings coming up this week.
Good plug. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW and online. We're joined now by Greg Whiteley from the film Most Likely to Succeed. Welcome.
Thanks.
And we have James Faust and John Wildman here to have a nice conversation.
It's going to be a very nice conversation because I've made no secret of the fact that I love this movie. And Greg, let's just start off quickly for people that aren't familiar with the movie and tell us how you started and what it is.
Well, the film begins, and I can't remember which happened first, but there was a man named Ted Dintersmith, who was a venture capitalist out of Boston, retired. President Obama appointed him to the UN as an education envoy, and it was an issue that he decided that he just wanted to take on. And so had spent, by the time I'd met him, I think the last 6 years, fairly intensely looking at the issue of education, what maybe needed to be done in this country to fix it. It's an issue that I've been interested in. It's something we touched on in a film, my second film, called Resolved. And I was convinced that really what we needed to do to fix education in this country was narrow the gap between inner city schools and high-performing, more wealthy schools. And that meant raising test scores, trying to match China, Korea, et cetera. And then I met Ted, and it happened to coincide right with a time that my daughter, who's in fourth grade when we began filming, had just decided to stop going to school, that it just wasn't for her. And so education was on the forefront of my mind, and I was easy pickings for Ted to pitch his idea. And he was really great in that he just said, listen, I'm not going to tell you what to think. I'm just going to point you in a direction of some schools that I've become acquainted with over the last 6 years and a couple of educational thought leaders, one of them being Tony Wagner, who had written a book called The Global Achievement Gap. And over the next few months, I just became a convert. I flipped. I realized that the way I was looking at education was probably symptomatic of how I was educated. And I was introduced to a whole new way to look at education, and that's really where we begin in the movie.
Well, you know, and it's one of the reasons I've been very aggressive in kind of pushing people toward this film is that I think just like it, the idea of getting people in to see the film and you think, well, it's a film about education. You go, oh, God, that's going to be a slog, isn't it? And you go, no, it's not going to be a slog. And ironically, that's the problem with education is that for kids, it's a slog because people are mired in, as you say, this testing, problem rather than which I love in the film and in these schools, this idea of, no, you're working on projects, because when you get in the world, it's about working on projects. And can you talk about what you discovered?
Yeah. Well, he said, look, I'm going to send you 12 schools. But my favorite is this one in San Diego. We went around and did our due diligence and went to the other 11 schools, and they're amazing. They're all doing different things. They don't necessarily work with projects, and I was still just as impressed. But the place that we focused on, the one you're mentioning, is this little school in San Diego called High Tech High.
High Tech High.
And it's the lowest tech school I've ever been in. Their computers are 8 years old. Their internet is slower than dial-up, and yet they've got this way of working that from the very first minute that we stepped on campus, we were blown away. First off, if you were to go, anybody can go to High Tech High. They've got an open campus. And the moment you walk in, the first thing you're going to notice is it's really difficult to find the teacher. And it looks, in some cases, like chaos. Kids are milling around. They're arguing with each other. They're working on stuff. It almost looks like it's the last day of school and the teacher just said, oh, just do whatever you want. And that's a typical day at High Tech High. What you learn, as we did, as we spent 2 years filming there, is that there's this method to this madness. They allow this student-driven curriculum to shape and form over the course of a semester or a year, in the case of these ninth graders that we followed. What they're doing when they're arguing with each other or they're playing or they're fighting, they're working in these teams that have been formed by the teachers to create these projects that will ultimately be their final exam each semester. So each semester they have a thing called exhibition night. There are no written final exams at this school. Instead, they have to show something that demonstrates their learning over that semester. So these kids were studying Greek mythology, and they decided we're gonna put up a play on Euripides' Trojan Women, only we're going to set it in modern-day Pakistan. And then there's another class across the hall who spent the semester studying the rise and fall of civilization. And what we're going to do is we're going to create this giant clock. And you think, well, what are you learning when you do that? And as it turns out, a lot. I think that's probably the chief premise of our film, is that they take a great departed step from content learning and they focus on this project-based learning. And there are many ways to achieve this, but they do it through these projects. And what we learned is that these kids come out with a depth of knowledge on one topic, which is good. But they also had this very advanced set of skills at a young age, an ability to communicate, which I didn't see other schools have in ninth grade, an ability to work well in teams, an ability to persevere. Like, for instance, during a project, you'll mess up and you'll fail. And they learn to just, well, that's okay, that's part of it. And they just keep at it, they keep working at it. And then there's a host of other skills that get developed. And we make a pretty good economic argument, I think, in the film for why these kids might have a leg up on other kids.
Well, yeah, it's what they call soft skills, right?
And I hate that phrase because it just sounds so kumbaya.
Yeah, but what's great? It's like again, when you are hiring people in the workplace, or you're trying to work with people in your office, they are the skills that aren't taught, and those are the skills that you value at those times.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's like you were saying before, the way we've been taught. I mean, it's what I learned in your film, which I thought was great, 124 years ago. Was when the way they going from class, you turn science for an hour, this for an hour, that sort of learning for the test.
Yeah.
And that's just not real learning. I mean, I live in a state that, you know, is constantly behind in Texas in education. And I've always said learning for a test is not really learning anything. And it seems your movie, exemplifies that.
Well, and, there was a time that it served us very well. before computers, before you could look up information on the internet, it was very helpful. It was a good skill to be able to memorize content and then have the ability to spit it back out the way it was given to you. Because, well, traditionally, that was the way we passed down knowledge, right? Before we learned to read and write, we would take in facts and then we would express them. And we don't make the argument that facts aren't important anymore, but what we're saying is it's not enough to just memorize facts. You've got to learn what to do with them once you get them. And the head of Google, the head of hiring at Google, Laszlo Bock, a vice president there, who appears in our film, makes this really great argument. He says, we are seeing kids who have gone through the current system and have graduated from the top schools, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Berkeley, you know, these name brand schools that traditionally means if you graduate from there, you're pretty much guaranteed not just a job, but a great job. And he's finding over and over that they're getting these kids perfect scores on their SAT, and they can't do the work. They're really crappy at working in teams. They're really bad at thinking outside the box or thinking critically. Moreover, he said, they're horrible when they experience failure. Because in our current system right now, if somebody has graduated from Yale with a perfect score on their SAT, top of their class, they've likely never failed. So they're now 22, 23 years old, never having had that experience and knowing what to do with it, versus another person who's experienced lots of failure in their life, me being one of them, you start to learn that failure is not an end. It's this opportunity, and as you know, as soft as that may sound, it's a needed ingredient in the 21st century. It's something that will set you apart. Something else we should keep in mind is that the current system, this is the first time in the history of our educational system that we're now seeing 53% unemployment among recent college graduates. And we think it's symptomatic not just of an economy, it's symptomatic of a way we're choosing to educate our kids that belonged to a different age.
Again, we've been speaking with Greg Whiteley from the film Most Likely to Succeed. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope your Sundance goes really well.
Oh, it already has, but thank you. It's such a thrill to be here. Thanks for having me.
Nice.
Listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW and online. We're joined now by Amy Berg, John Krakauer, and Sam Brower from the documentary Prophets Pray. And joining me is my co-host John Wildman, who's going to be speaking with you. Welcome.
Okay. I've been looking forward to talking to you guys about this subject, about this guy, and how you got into it. Warren Jeffs is an infamous person and character, I think, by this point for a lot of people. And what I really enjoyed about the documentary is how much that you are able to drill down and present that portrait that a lot of people like myself just have received glimpses of through various news reports over time. And so you go, what actually happened? What really went down there? And this film, I think, does that very successfully. What I'd like to start off with, John and Sam, I know the two of you have been involved with this for quite some time. Amy, how did you get involved? How did this project come to you?
Well, John obviously wrote Under the Banner of Heaven, and they're making a fictional film at Imagine Entertainment. And when John was negotiating his deal, he made sure that a documentary was carved into the deal so that this story could get out, because this is the story behind the story that is very important. And I was approached by them and very intrigued. Right away, it was just a news story to me at the time. And then when I started hearing some of the prophecies and reading some of the kind of insane dialogue coming from that camp, I was very interested in kind of understanding how people were brainwashed by this man.
And John and Sam, if you two could talk, I mean, you've been within this world, investigating it, following it for some time. And can you talk about what that experience has been for both of you?
I should clarify a little bit. I mean, after I wrote Under the Banner and Sam and I met to try to bring Warren Jeffs to justice, I have dipped in and out of it. I mean, I've had other things going on. Sam lives in the heart of it, and he's the driving force. I mean, this film takes the title Prophets Pray is from his book of the same name. So, you know, Sam, no one in the world knows a fraction about Warren Jeffs and these people as much as Sam does.
Well, I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Well, you've been immersed in both the Ophelia's world and Warren Jeff's path and you know the pursuit of him. Mm-hmm. And you, could you talk about that?
It's started years ago, and I think I don't think a lot of people in Utah know the depth of the depravity. And of course, when I found out, it's you get to the point where you just can't turn your back on it. It's so horrible, you just can't just look the other way and let it go by. And hopefully this film will get the word out on a national level or international level where more people can understand what's going on, and even people in Utah and Arizona can begin to, like you say, get a feel for what happened behind the scenes and get a feel for just how sick and demented this whole thing that's going on right here in our state, in our country, is.
And can you all speak to, Amy specifically, how you were able to get the footage, the audio, because this is, by definition, the most secretive community and the most walled off, situation, and yet you guys got some fascinating footage, and some very creepy audio of Jeff speaking. So could you talk to me that?
Well, one of the greatest coups was when we were down in Texas, El Dorado, Texas, and the sheriff had recently switched his computer system over, and he reminded me that they had put a surveillance camera in the cell where Warren was staying for all those months, and he just said, "Let me just check my computer here for a second," and it turned out there were hours and hours of Warren just doing interesting things in his cell, and that kind of opened it up for us because we were able to record a deposition that took place in February based on Sam's investigation, and we also had access to all of these prophecies through Sam, and so it kind of painted the perfect picture, which was what we wanted to do in the beginning. We wanted to show the mind of Warren Jeffs and how he was able to manipulate people. So those were some great elements.
Well, it's funny, that surveillance footage, I'm glad you brought that up, because as I was watching, it had a creepiness of literally like a paranormal activity, you know, and you know, because again, you know, you're watching, and this is a person who, what he believes, even in himself. I mean, you know, you go, this is it's a fascinating study. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and the camera doesn't lie.
No, I mean, just watching a man stand receiving a revelation in place in his cell for hours, it's odd.
It was so bizarre and cool to see that.
Right. And the idea that he was reaching people from jail, I thought was a very important thing to show in the film, to show that there are people on the outside listening to this madman who is going insane in prison. So,
that's one of the really great things about the film, too, is the fact that there is no video of Warren Jeffs anywhere. And to see that, you know, Warren was on the run. He was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And to finally see him living, breathing in a cell and being deposed was really great.
That scene where he's on the phone to one of his followers, you know, talking through the glass, and says, "Hold on, I'm talking to God. God's talking," you know, and it's like, coming in, you know, and it's like, what?
Yeah. Well, ET phone home.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, and the other, you know, aspect of that, that I think the film illustrates very well is that culture of fear. And that unspoken threat, and in the interviews that you have with the various people that have escaped, so to speak, or still have one foot in, one foot out, I'd love to hear how how difficult it was to get those people to speak on camera, and what that process was like.
Well, Janetta Jessup, who was wife number 63, had never spoken to anyone before, and she did not trust many people because she had been she's been out for a bit and tried to reach out to her mother, who wouldn't talk to her, and she just felt like she was stuck between two worlds. So I thought that her interview was really emotional, and it shared a lot for me as a woman of what it was like to be brainwashed in the church. But Sam's relationships with many people who are actively fighting today against Warren and Lyle and the church and the trust. I mean, these are people who have never spoken publicly before. His former head of security, the current leader's son. I mean, these were really interesting people that had a lot to say.
Well, you know, there are more than a few films in the fest that that take its personality from audio of people speaking mm-hmm. through this, and this one certainly does. Mm-hmm. You know, I do have to say that I was entertaining my housemates by doing my Warren Jeffs impersonation from his God voice. It lends again. It lends a very active, literally a voice to what those people that you're interviewing. What's obviously still speaking at mm-hmm. what they still fear and what's in their head, that threat. And what I'm curious also is this seems a subject that could bear further investigation, even with him in jail. And I wonder if there's any ambition to do that. I know there's a narrative film that's in process. Mm-hmm. But do you see like a possible continuation of that community?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why this is the greatest festival for this film to play at, is because there are so many people in this community here who have already reached out to us last night and today saying, how can we help? We want to put money into a further investigation. We want to help the children. We want to help the women. So Sundance is, there is no other place that we could bring this film and have this kind of immediate reaction, I think.
Well, I think the film is by its very definition a primer on Warren Jeffs, that personality and the situation with this. And congratulations, all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Again, we've been speaking with the filmmakers behind the film Prophet's Prey, which is playing here at Sundance. We've had Amy Berg, the director, John Krakauer, executive producer, and Sam Brower, producer. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. I'm Dominic Mill. I'm joined by my comparable co-host, John Wildman, and we're going to be talking to Brad Besser, the director, and Trent Harris, the subject of Beaver Trilogy Part 4, which, as from the title you might glean, is the sequel to a trilogy of films, the Beaver Trilogy, which was inspired by a chance meeting between filmmaker Trent Harris and a young man from Beaver, Utah, in a parking lot in 1979. John, I'm going to throw it to you to kick off the questioning. Fire away, my man.
Well, it's funny because I wrote a note on this. I think you guys may be, and you've got competition this year, but you guys may be the ultimate Sundance legacy film, I think. Brad, I want to start with you because, I wrote in, when I was writing my review for the film, I said that I thought that you could make a film just based on Trent alone, because of his personality and
now wait a minute.
but you, as the director, had to not just focus on Trent as a subject, but also the films themselves. And I'm curious as to how you went about that, how you placed your emphasis as the filmmaker.
Well, I actually thought that the Beaver Trilogy was a nice gateway into being able to tell the rest of Trent's story, I think when you watch the Beaver Trilogy, you come away with two questions: what happened to the Beaver Kid, and why did this director do this? What kind of a director, what kind of a person would make these films? And so, really, this is kind of showing those angles, and I figured that Beaver Trilogy is like the natural way to get into a larger story.
Well, and Trent, Groovin' Gary or the Beaver Kid, he's kind of like your white whale.
That's a good way to put it. I hadn't thought of that before,
You are the Ahab in this, and
he is now. now Brad is.
Well, you're taking me right to my question, which is, do you kind of feel like you're passing the baton to Brad?
I hope so, because I am so tired of talking about this movie.